Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition, Answers for the Family. I'm your guest host, Christine Baumgartner.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your guest host, Christine Baumgartner. Every Monday from 11 to noon, the show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address topics such as health and longevity, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. I'm sure many of you expected to hear and see Alan, and I am not. We're reminded of the reality of what he does when he's not on the air. As a licensed private investigator and crisis interventionalist, he gets calls and has to respond quickly. Be it locating a runaway, escorting a teen to a specialized program, or retrieving an abducted child. I spoke to him this morning and learned that he has been asked to assist with a teen who's having extreme anxiety and panic attacks, and there's a great concern that he may harm himself. I believe once tested for the COVID-19 virus, Alan and his team plan to therapeutically escort him to a residential treatment program that will evaluate and help him. So good luck, Alan, and what an amazing job he does. So on to our topic for today. The title of our guest's new book, What to Say to Kids When Nothing Seems to Work, A Practical Guide for Parents and Caregivers. Our guests are Ashley Miller, and MD, and Adele LaFrance, PhD. Dr. Miller is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at BC Children's Hospital and a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UBC, which is the University of British Columbia, I just learned. She is also the co-director of interpersonal psychotherapy and family therapy training for the UBC Psychiatry Residency Program. As part of her work, Dr. Miller runs support groups for teens with depression and caregiver groups for families. She's a passionate advocate for family and caregiver involvement in the mental health treatment of children and youth. Dr. LaFrance is an internationally recognized clinical psychologist, research scientist, and co-developer of emotional-focused family therapy. She offers workshops for the general public and mental health agencies worldwide. A frequent keynote speaker at professional conferences, Dr. LaFrance has published extensively in the field of emotional health, including a clinical manual to support families published by the American Psychological Association. In addition to her work as a psychologist and academic, Dr. LaFrance is passionate about helping parents to support their kids in a way that's informed by the latest developments in neuroscience. Geez, you guys are so smart. Our topic today and the title of our guest's new book, What to Say to Kids When Nothing Seems to Work, A Practical Guide for Parents and Caregivers. What to Say to Kids When Nothing Seems to Work offers parents an effective step-by-step guide to some of the most common struggles for kids aged 5 through 12. Written by mental health professionals Dr. Ashley Miller and Dr. Adele LaFrance, with over 30 years' experience listening to kids' thoughts and feelings. That's so important. This book provides a framework to explore new ways of responding to your child that will help them calm down faster and boost their resilience to stress. With a dose of humor and plenty of real-life examples, the authors will guide you to build a bridge into your child's world to make sense of their emotions and behavior. Sample scenarios and scripts are provided for you to customize based on your caregiving style and your child's personality. These are then followed by concrete support strategies to help you manage current and future situations in a way that leaves everyone feeling better. Chapters are organized by common kid-related issues so you can quickly find what's relevant to you. Suitable for parents, grandparents, and other caregivers of children, preteens, as well as professionals working closely with families. What to Say to Kids When Nothing Seems to Work is an accessible resource for effectively navigating the twists, turns, and sometimes total chaos of life with kids. Oh my. So welcome to the guests. I'm so excited to talk to you. This is a fascinating subject.
Thanks for having us, Christine.
Oh, you're so welcome. So outside of the normal questions, when we think about what Alan's doing today with this young person, I'd love to just get a brief thought from each of you about what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we've, of course, lots of youth and families are struggling right now. I mean, in ways that we've never experienced before. And yet, a youth being very anxious and panicking and stuck at home, that is a kind of situation that happens outside of COVID times as well. And we do have lots of ways of helping youth in even the most difficult circumstances to get through.
Yeah, it's really hard when your child is suffering so much. And, for parents are wired to their children. They are literally, wired neurobiologically, chemically. And so when you see your child in distress, it activates distress in yourself. And so it's really good to be able to get support from other people, friends, family, but other professionals to help weather those storms. It can be really intense. And so, yeah, I'm so glad to hear that family is getting some support.
Yeah. It's one of those catchy things where you keep make each other get more and more and more hard or more and more and more calm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Calm is contagious too. Right. And so as we can be more aware of the hopefulness out there, and as parents get more support to manage their own concerns and anxiety, that benefits our children so much.
Yeah. And being able to open a book to a specific chapter. I love that.
Yes.
So ladies, you spend all day talking to kids and parents.
Mm-hmm.
What do the kids say they want their parents to say to them?
Well, kids, they want parents to be able to understand and acknowledge that the way they're feeling and thinking makes sense, that it's they're good people who are doing the best they can. I mean, we all want that, right? And so kids want parents to be able to say, yeah, I understand why you might feel that way. Or I can imagine if I put myself in your shoes, it might be kind of like this. And that makes sense to them.
Yeah. One of the things that I've noticed a lot in my practice is that parents are afraid sometimes to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, and say they'd rather have a professional come in and help their child. And sometimes that's absolutely necessary, depending on what's going on. But there is a percentage, of kids who really just want to talk to their parents and who want their parents to get a little bit of help to hold their experience in a slightly different way. So it doesn't have to be like super different, Parents don't have to go and become therapists. But with a couple of tools, techniques, and new strategies, it can make a world of difference. And so many times, kids have said, like, no offense, but I don't really want to talk to you, Adele. Like, I'd rather figure it out with my parents. So that's something that we really wanted to kind of convey in the book, that professional help can be very helpful. And also, parents are who children want most. And with a few little tweaks, it can be really wonderful.
Wow. I love your answers. So as you said, the parents feel connected to their kids and they see that they're in stress or in pain. And then the problem is parents try to fix the problem. There must be a fix. There must be something I can do instead of listening to what the kids want from them. So why do you think that we have parents have that in their heads that they just need to fix it rather than listen?
Yeah, that's, I mean, even we do that. So that's like the hilarious thing. It's like we wrote this book, and if our kids were listening, they would probably be like, that's so funny that you're telling people not to rush into fix and reassure, because that's kind of what you do some of the time. And it's really deeply ingrained. It's deeply ingrained in our culture, you know, so we're like socialized to respond to people's stress or distress with reassurance or problem solving, even though the neuroscience is totally against doing it that way. Yeah. So that's one of the reasons. But the other reason is that, you know, when our kids are suffering, it hurts us too. And so consciously or unconsciously, like, we want to try to make that pain go away as quickly as possible. And what we've learned is to lean away from the pain. Again, even though we know that what we resist persists, that leaning away isn't actually going to make the problem go away. But it's so normal that we want all parents to kind of just hear that. Like, we even do it on a regular basis. It's like learning a new language. It's like pivoting from a really kind of well-worn track that we are comfortable with. But, you know, it can be really worthwhile to flex that muscle in a different way.
And one of the things that I'll often say to parents is that listening to your kids and what they're experiencing and acknowledging that you think it totally makes sense is doing something. Like, that actually is doing something. And kids appreciate it so much. And they tell us, I can't believe it. My mom, she didn't jump in to fix it this time. She just listened to what I wanted. And she said that she understood. And I think she really got me. I felt so much better. I'm like, really? That made you feel better? And she's like, yeah, that's all I wanted. And of course, you know, younger kids often do need parents to come in with practical suggestions too. So we're not saying, oh, just listen. I mean, kids need help. Teens need support too. It's really just doing it first to see how much support does the kid need. And you can ask kids, is this a situation where you want me to just listen? Do you want me to listen and help you problem solve? Or do you want me to actually help you find the solution? Because sometimes kids do want you to help them find the solution right away.
It's amazing how often the kid will know the answer. If you give them multiple choice, they'll know which one to pick.
That's right. That's right.
So you don't know I'm a dating and relationship coach, and the same thing. I have to have my backup people who go, but Christine, you know, this is what you teach and you have to remember to do it yourself.
Yeah.
We're in good company.
Oh, yeah. So we're human beings and we have to call ourselves out and say, you know, as Maya Angelou said, you know, we do best what we knew then. And now that we know better, we do better. And I write lots of passes for me and for my clients of, you know, we don't know and we forget and we're hungry and tired and we forget. Yeah.
Well, to that point, we actually dedicate a whole chapter of the book on what we call the do-over. So that when we forget everything or we do it like the, like, quote unquote, wrong way, or we say something that we, you know, really regret later, there's actually a protocol so that you can go back, address it. And more often than not, it actually strengthens, you know, the relationship. So the good news is it's never too late.
Oh, that's so good to hear. I tell my couples that too, that hardly anything you can't go back and call yourself out about. You know, give yourself grace first, and then you offer grace to the other person. And I think it's such an important thing for kids to learn, don't you think? That you do it as example for yourself, and then they go, oh, well, it must be okay to do that.
Exactly. We want to model self-forgiveness and that it's always possible to repair. So when we as parents can come back to our kids and say, oh, you know what? I know I said this before. I wish I had been able to say it in this way. And we start over, that's teaching our kids that they can do the same thing with their friends and their relationships. Mm-hmm. And there's always a way to make repair. It's not even that that's unusual. That's how all relationships are. Mm-hmm. We try, we stumble, we try again, we keep realigning until we connect. And that's really how it goes.
Yeah, I was working with a mom recently, and there was an emotional injury between she and her adult daughter. And it was the emotional injury was 25, 30 years old. And honestly, she used that simple structure that we described in the book. And it cleared a pathway that no one in the family ever thought possible, including the siblings who had witnessed the power of that emotional injury. And so, you know, this book is primarily for parents, caregivers of kids and tweens, but the principles actually apply across the lifespan. And when you're talking about parent-child relationships, that bond is titanium. You know, like some, we just need to get kinks out of the way, blocks out of the way. And there's a way to do that. There's a specific way to do that. But it's just really encouraging for me anyways to know that it, pretty much anything can be healed.
Yes. It's yes. Great. I think that's a perfect answer. I like it a lot. So why do you think kids, some kids need more validation and emotional support than others?
Well, some kids have just been through more in their life, and some kids are wired differently. There's actually research to show that there's a certain percentage of the population who are more emotionally sensitive than others. Yeah. And there's just different life circumstances too. So if you've grown up with extreme difficulties in your life, in your community, it's not a wonder that you might need more support to fill up some of the holes that might be there from earlier on. So we all, you know, all parents of more than one kid know that kids are different, right? Everyone knows that. And so to ask yourself or to say, well, why does my son seem to need more? I was pretty sturdy as a kid. My daughter's really sturdy. And to sort of feel frustrated by that, it's normal to feel frustrated. But at the same time, we just need to give sometimes for the needs of the individual child.
Yeah, and there's even brain changes in kids who are more sensitive to their environment. Like we sometimes refer to them as super feelers because they can pick up on stress or distress in the environment in a way that other people can't. Like it's a heightened awareness. And at the brain level, some of the theories that are emerging is that like some of these kids have overactive limbic systems. So the alarm center in the brain is just a bit more easily triggered. And it could also be that when we receive soothing, our hypothalamus actually secretes calming neurochemicals. And those calming neurochemicals produce a calming effect on the emotional center of the brain. Well, people are neuroscientists are starting to think that it's possible that there are some kids who don't have as many receptors for those calming neurochemicals in the limbic system, the emotional center of the brain. So they need a more continuous flow of soothing and support. So it could also be just a fundamental, you know, difference in how the brain is working. It still works the same way, but needing a little bit more. And some parents have really talked to us with relief about knowing that, because then it doesn't become personal, or they're not worried that their child is like not maturing, you know, at the right rate or speed. They're going to get there. It just might take a little bit longer.
Yeah. And now like it really has a lot to do with the whole divide of the nature nurture. You know, some kids are just born that way. Some people are created that way, depending on how you're born, your circumstances affect you differently. Mm-hmm. Wow. So you suss that all out. That's amazing.
Well, it's really interesting. And I feel like the more parents and children can kind of get to know themselves as unique individuals, the more that they'll be able to kind of meet those needs in a good way.
So your book has a chapter on managing disagreements between co-parents, you know, when they don't think the same thing. Why was this important to you to include? And what advice do you have for co-parents who disagree? I bet you run into that a lot.
Yeah, this is so natural, right? First of all, no two people are going to feel exactly the same way about anything. And when a kid is struggling, that totally raises co-parents' stress level and anxiety. And when we're feeling stressed, it's very normal to become more polarized. So if a kid says, I'm scared, I don't want to go outside for a walk today, one parent might tend to become a little bit softer and say, well, that's okay. Of course, I totally understand. It's pretty scary right now. And the other one might then get their back up and say, but we can't just keep our kids inside all the time. And they're going to get really, you know, scared to leave the house. We've got to push them. So as one person gets softer, the other person gets tends to get harder. We try to balance each other out, fully natural. Yeah. And the thing is, when you're trying to parent, if you're feeling stressed, not only about what's going on with your child, but also about any judgment that you're worried you're going to get from your co-parent, then you can't do your job as well. So we really wanted to have a chapter in the book to address that, because that's happening to parents all the time. And what we recommend is using the same kinds of strategies with our co-parents. So to listen to their point of view and to try to build a bridge to understand how they're looking at it. So instead of getting more and more defensive on our side of the equation, trying to cross over and understand their point of view. So instead to say, I don't blame you for wanting to let him stay in, because it is scary out there right now. And it is a stressful time for everyone. And trust me, I don't want him to become a shut-in either. I also want him to get out a little bit more. And I'm wondering if we can talk about this and find a solution that works for both of us. So we're trying to use a compassionate approach with our co-parent as well. Because yes. There's no way to get through to the actual parenting if we're stuck fighting with our co-parent.
Oh, such a good point. So you talk about validating kids' feelings. What does that really mean? Does it mean validating their feelings? Does validating their feelings make kids think you agree with their negative behavior? You kind of addressed it a little with that, but...
Yeah. Yeah, well, probably best if we give an example, you know, like, because there are a lot of different definitions out there of what it means to validate. And when we do a little Google search, like Google images on what it means to validate, there's this cartoon and it's a guy who's getting his parking tag validated. And the woman says, you did a great job, you know, with your parking, evenly spaced, perfect right angle. And in our structure, in our model, you know, that's not validating at all. That's like encouraging, that's cheerleading. So the first thing is we just need to figure out, like, what does that actually mean? So in our model, we call it putting it into words. And so we put into words two or three reasons why it might make sense for your child to think, feel, or act in a certain way. And what happens when we do that, when the external environment, the parent, can reflect what's going on inside the child's mind, the activation in the limbic system and the emotional center actually kind of comes down, because it's like, oh, okay, you get it. You get the message I'm trying to communicate. And so now I can chill a little bit. And when the brain chills, it becomes more flexible. So let's say it's homework time. And the kid is like, I don't want to do homework. This is stupid. You know, if the parent can say something like, you know what? I can understand why you wouldn't want to do your homework, because chatting with your friends is way more fun. You've already had a long day at school, and math homework can be tough. Just by reflecting what's inside their head, the brain calms, and then you can transition to providing emotional support and practical support, and that child will be more flexible, more easily redirected. So it's not going to go from, you know, 100% resistance to 0% resistance, but it will create some flexibility so that when the parent says, you know what, I'll help you, why don't we get started with number one, the child is more likely to come alongside. They may still groan and moan, you know, but that flexibility is going to be there in a way that it wasn't three sentences ago.
Why don't you suggest parents send their kids to their rooms to calm down? I know sometimes I need to time out.
Yeah, and that's actually a really critical piece, is that as parents, we definitely need time out sometimes. Not in a punitive way, but just we might need a small break. It could be a break when we're in the room, where we're just taking sort of mental break by taking some deep breaths, not arguing for a moment, pressing pause on a disagreement. Mm-hmm. It might be an actual break where we need to say to our child or a partner for that matter, I need a couple minutes right now. I need to take some space just to calm down. I'll be back. Right? Because we don't want to, especially for younger children, we don't want to ever give them the sense that they're alone or that we're leaving them. But we, especially in close quarters, we might need some space. That's normal. So it's not that kids should never go to their rooms. But the idea of go to your room and calm down for especially a younger child who may not actually know how to calm down yet. You know, we talk a lot about self-regulation and that kids should go in to sort of figure it out, but it's a skill. And as parents, we can teach our kids co-regulation, how to calm down together. So we recommend, whether it's starting by playing a game with a younger child or just doing something that doesn't involve a lot of talking for an older child, and or using the strategies we describe in our book of trying to put into words some of the child's or teen's feelings, that's going to help them calm down with us. So that's what we're really recommending, that we want to teach the skills. And then sometimes if a child needs some space, it's not wrong for them to take some space and go to their room. We just don't want to use it as our primary or only strategy.
And I think too, like why the whole go to your room to calm down thing emerged was that like we really have not been equipping parents very well with the actual skills of co-regulation. So, you know, people are talking about co-regulation for self-regulation way more now in the scientific literature, in clinical practices, but actually providing parents with specific and concrete strategies on how to do that, we're a little behind the eight ball here. So, you know, I really want parents listening to not feel bad if they've used those strategies repeatedly, because frankly, we haven't done a good job as a field to kind of give them other strategies that work, especially in the heat of the moment.
Mm. Yeah. The what to do when a child is angry, especially. I mean, we all need space sometimes when we're angry, but we also really do well when someone says, I don't blame you for being angry at me because I was really in your space just now. And all you wanted was a minute for yourself. And it's amazing. But I said that the other day, and then the person I was upset with was able to stay in the room with me because I had acknowledged and validated the anger, which was at me, which is a hard thing to do. But that's why we really wanted to give specific examples in the book, sentences you can say to get people started. This is a new way of talking.
And if you noticed, Ashley had more passion in her voice when she said it. She's like, I can understand why you'd feel angry with me. That is also a neuroscience trick. The more passionately you can validate, the more the other person's brain responds in a positive and productive manner, as long as it's not, you know, sarcastic or condescending. If it's a true like show of, I can understand why you would feel that way, that energy, that activation can go a really, really long way. It's really awkward though at first, because in so many of our micro cultures, like we're supposed to be like calm and not get too animated, especially when someone else is angry with us, you know, unless it's with defensiveness. So putting into words another person's experience with energy can go a long way, you know, in response to anger. And it shows the other person that anger is not bad and anger is not scary. Mm-hmm. And in our culture, we have a bit of a way to go to help transform our view of anger. Like it's like we see anger as scary, dangerous, and there are versions of anger that are not positive, you know, and that we would call it rejecting anger. But assertive anger is like a wellspring of vitality. It's I love myself so much that I want to talk about how I feel. I want to, you know, defend my boundary. I want to be heard. I want to join with you. So one of the things that, we want to encourage parents to consider is that anger can actually be a beautiful, vital, connecting emotion, so long as we know what to do with it.
Yeah. Wow. That's great information that I need to digest. And so I think it's a really good time for a commercial break, and I'm going to digest what you've been saying, and we'll be back in just a minute. Maybe. Maybe not. Okay. Maybe not. We'll go on. Okay. Next question. I can digest later. Can you give an example of what to say when my child suggests that I love my other child more? Oh, I remember saying that as a kid. Look what they do. Yeah.
Yeah. This is it's a juicy one. You know, any parent of more than one child has likely heard it. You know, whether it's a traditional family or a blended family, and it can really be activating because, of course, parents love their children so deeply, and when they hear that, it can be hard to hear. But what we found is that when kids say that, especially younger kids and, you know, tweens, they're picking up on something that they don't quite know how to interpret, and because they're immature, you know, in terms of their social and emotional development, their brain structures even, they deduce that it must be because my parent loves my sister more. So for example, if an older child is allowed to do more, the younger child doesn't appreciate the maturation processes that are influencing the different rules. They don't appreciate circumstantial differences in terms of children's unique needs. And so they see this disconnect and, you know, their primitive brain goes, oh, well, it must be because mom loves her more. So first is just for parents to understand, like they're picking up on something. They don't know how to interpret it. They apply this, you know, this belief to that discrepancy to understand it. And so we really want parents to kind of name what might be going on for the kid. Like, yeah, I can understand why you'd feel that way because I have been spending more time with your sister and she and I have more in common in terms of shared interests. And so I could see from your perspective that it would look like I love her more. It seems easier. And then you can reassure and say all the things that we all want to say, like as a knee-jerk response, like, of course I love you the same, or, you know, or being playful, like, well, she doesn't give me as much of a hard time as you do, or something like that, you know? So starting off with understanding where they're coming from, being able to put it into words, and then providing that nice reassurance and even problem solving, like that's usually an indication that that child has a need for connection, you know, whether it's a little bit more, more often or more intimate. So that's another cue that parents can take.
Okay. So this book isn't just for parents of small children. You also discuss topics like depression and anxiety in teenagers, like the poor teenager we heard about earlier. Mm-hmm. Do you have strategies in your book that might improve kids and teens' mental health?
One of our hopes is that through these kinds of conversations, you know, we know that mental health is complex. Mental health problems are not caused by parenting or by parents. And sometimes parents worry. I'd say a lot of the time parents worry that there's got to be, you know, something they did or didn't do. And that's just not the case. So parenting and ways that we talk to our kids are not going to prevent mental health issues. But when kids are struggling, parents are their best allies and advocates, right? Mm-hmm. We may see as professionals, we may see a kid for an hour a week at best, but parents are there 24/7 doing the heavy lifting, and that relationship can be really protective. So when your child is struggling, these kinds of strategies and these ways of talking and being are even more important. They're always helpful, but they're even more important in those really hard times. So when a teen is or a child is really anxious, their brain is really overactive in the fear centers. And a parent's calming presence, knowing that you're not alone, is soothing and helps the child with their fear. And when you know you're not alone, then you are much more flexible to take in whatever the recommendations are. So for example, let's say a child who has obsessive compulsive disorder needs to do specific treatment, which involves exposing themselves to the things they're afraid of, and then resisting the urge to engage in the ritual. Like maybe they normally check if the doors are locked over and over again, but now they need to not check. What do they do with the anxiety that rises in them as they're not checking? if their parent or caregiver can help with this kind of language and this kind of presence with them, they'll learn how to manage the distress more easily and they'll be able to do their treatment more effectively. So that's just one of many, many examples and ways in which the strategies in this book can help a parent or caregiver of a child with mental health issues to recover more quickly.
So interesting. So we know there's lots of parenting books in the world, and you've given so many examples already, but I'd love for you to give a couple more of what sets your book apart.
Yeah, well, you know, we really do believe that, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. And so there are so many really excellent parenting books out there. John Gottman, Daniel Siegel and his colleagues, Gordon Neufeld, like they've written some really beautiful books that I feel have allowed us to get to this place. And so what Ashley and I wanted to do was translate the best of these advances in psychology and psychiatry and neuroscience and parent-child relationships into really, really clear and concrete strategies. So we do explain at the brain level what happens when we attend to our kids in the way we've described. We have like a very clear framework on what to say and what to do, so that we move from the theoretical, the conceptual, to extremely practical. We give script specific scenarios. Both of us in our offices, we can't tell you how many times we've given examples to parents and they've said, like, can you write that down? Because in the moment, I'm not going to remember, you know? And so we'd like scribble down these scripts. And so we thought, why aren't we putting this in a book? And so literally this many, many scripts that we've written for parents, like we've put them in this book so that parents be like, okay, I get that. Makes sense. I can remember to do that in the moment. So those are kind of some of the ways that I feel like our book is a little bit different. Ashley, what would you say?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think a lot of parenting books are kind of aspirational. Like, what would your best self do? How do you want it to be? And we wanted to add to that with like, what do you actually do when it's really hard in that really difficult moment? And what can you actually say? And we want to break it down so it's really concrete. Like when there's aggressive behavior between your kids, what can you do in that moment? When your kid is saying, I really miss my best friend, what do you do in that moment? And of course, I can't answer all the situations. And we want to address all the different feelings. Because again, a lot of parenting strategies are more around behavior, around consequences, and that's all extremely important. And then other ones talk about feelings. We wanted to bring them together so that you have both the parts about how do you deal with the feelings and not. Because often the one parents who we really like talking about feelings will buy the books that are about feelings. And parents who really like discipline and, you know, setting limits will buy the books about discipline. And we wanted to say, okay, well, here's a book. Doesn't matter what your preference is. Both things are super important. So let's put them together and let's honor. You know, I just want to mention Dr. Sue Johnson, who's a leading couples researcher and therapist, one of my teachers, and who in her model with Gail Palmer and others around family therapy, very similar. And we want to just, again, bring the specific examples to specific parent situations to grow the bonds and help parents and kids connect even on a deeper level.
A how to.
Yeah.
I love it. I love you. I love it. So there, because, you know, Alan promotes the show ahead of time, there were a couple of people that wrote in questions. As an elementary school teacher, I've heard from so many parents that their kids are acting entitled, lonely, and indifferent. My family started talking about the me generation, and we're concerned that screen time and always being self-need-centric have a lot to do with the change in children. So how do we help parents make these changes? I'm excited to read your book and learn more about how your methods could make a difference. Ariel from Connecticut.
Oh, that's really a great question.
Isn't that so nice?
Yeah, thanks, Ariel. So, I mean, maybe I'll say a few things and see what Ashley has to say. The one thing about screen time is that we have to be really careful about our judgment of kids and parents who use screen time. parents who don't have as much community or who don't have as many resources sometimes have to use screen time to keep their kids safe. You know, I think about the single mom who's working two jobs and has a toddler and she needs to have a shower. You know, like the screen time can actually be a way to keep her daughter safe while she attends to herself in these really, really basic ways. The other thing is that when we look in families, screen time, yeah, screen time use is a problem for sure. But I think the bigger problem is lack of connection. And we don't raise our children in communities like we used to. And so it's almost impossible for parents to be able to attend to their children's emotional needs on their own, you know, without grandma and the community center and so on and so forth. So I think that screen time is a symptom of something bigger, something more systemic. And so I would love to see like communities coming together in different ways so that kids can be fueled by that community love, that community holding, which makes it so that the screens just aren't as compelling, you know, because they're getting the real life goodness from people around them who care. And screens can't compete with that.
Yeah. And I totally agree with what it, you know, Adele is saying. And I also encourage parents and educators to ask kids, and older kids and teens can for sure do this, to just notice how they feel after they've been, whether it's watching something passively on YouTube or on social media, because it's about teaching awareness of your own emotions. And so what kids start to notice is maybe they feel good after they've chatted with a friend, but maybe they don't feel so good after they've been scrolling on social media, reading about other people's lives or what they're doing. And that when the penny drops and like, actually, I felt pretty bad, you can help them start to become aware of the impact. And I think that's how we're going to transform this me kind of situation, by developing actually more emotional awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, it makes sense, because how much better do you feel? I think that's such a good thing, because we don't pay attention to that. You know, like if you eat well or you don't, just making, you know, still eat the same way, but make a decision to pay attention, because then you're like, well, maybe I did feel better if I ate lunch before I had three cookies, you know? So the same way with the comparison of, oh, friend versus an inanimate screen time. I like the way you put that. Okay, another question. I love the premise of your book. I have a question. We have so many parents who are, now we're going to talk about the spoiled parents. Parents who are spoiled, poorly taught, just very immature themselves, who are passing down their stereotypes and preconceived notions to their children. It seems that the problem needs to start from the top down. Does your book help parents realize their behavior as they're dealing with that of their children? Henry from Oregon. I know you've talked about it a little bit, but there you go. It's more about that.
I so appreciate that question. And I have to say that, you know, before I became a parent, I had a lot of different ideas. But, and you know, even as a parent, I do agree with the sense that it does need to start with us. But I look at every parent was once a child, and every parent is still a human, and we are all struggling. I mean, especially now we're all struggling, but in general in day-to-day life, and we have fears and we have hopes, and sometimes we get hijacked by our fears, right? Especially if something that's happening with our child really reminds us of something that happened to us, like if we were left out as kids and now we see our child being left out. And when we get hijacked by fear, we may not behave in the way that is the best. We may not behave in the way that we want to. So, you know, we really see it as supporting parents to support their kids, and whether that's community, so practical support, like reaching out, offering to spend some time with someone's child so they can have a break, right? Or being kind to that parent, validating their feelings and their difficulty. I think that's where it's, I think criticizing parents is not going to make them better, but we hope that in giving strategies to connect and seeing parents' best intentions, we are going to help children.
Yeah. I see on Facebook, you know, and other social media, sometimes there'll be like little posters that'll say, kids just need blank, or kids are doing the best they can. And while I appreciate the message, implicit in that is criticism. You know, you're like, you're not seeing that kids just need this. And we know at the brain level, psychologically, that criticism, implicit or not, increases defenses, increases rigidity, increases reactive behavior. And so it really is important to kind of lean in to see like, what is the best intention of this parent, even though they may not be behaving in the way that we feel is going to be most productive. And Ashley and I have had the opportunity to work with, you know, quite a number of parents who have behaved in ways that were very, very hurtful or harmful to their children. And I call it an opportunity because it really has shown me that people are struggling. People who behave that way are struggling. They need support. And with the right kind of support, they can turn it around. They really can. So there is a message of hope in there, so that there are people, you know, out there supporting these parents in a good way so that they can show up in the best way possible for their kids.
And it sounds like it could really be an internal healing for the parents, then even maybe help them with their relationship with their parents. I mean, really, it just seems like it could heal for generations, backward and forward. I mean, I just keep hearing that so much talked about with your book. Well, yeah, I hope he buys it. I do. I think it's amazing. I mean, just what I've heard, I have to get the book. It's fascinating, really.
Thank you for your support.
You're so welcome. And thank you so much for coming and sharing about this very important information. I think it's important all the time. And now when everybody's so together, getting about, we're so together, that, you know, helping with the kids is just phenomenal because they're the future generation. Mm-hmm. So I need to talk about next week's show. So please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we'll be with our guest, Deborah Keston, to discuss her new book, Whole Person Integrative Eating. Well, we were just talking about eating. A dietary lifestyle to treat the root cause of overeating, overweight, and obesity. Well, that's good. That would be important. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com or subscribe to our show through iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, YouTube, Spreaker, and SoundCloud. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people and be greatly appreciated. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check out some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word. So I know you're going to be doing that after this show, huh? Do you know about Answers for the Family before?
I did, actually, yeah. It's a great program. We're delighted to be on it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Helping children and their families, it's the core of our society. It's one of the things I say about in my area of the dating part of relationships, that the more we can feel comfortable and confident with ourselves, the better we interact with the people around us. And you know, it's like a little pebble in a pond. Where do those concentric circles touch? You know, what kind of human beings and adults would those children be? And what kind of children will they raise with these amazing tools that you're offering them? And this sounds like super easy. Okay, I have this problem. I'm looking it up in this part of the book. I'm going to say exactly what the doctors say, and it's going to make me feel like I have much better tools. You know, I've gone down the Home Depot aisle, and I didn't know there were so many different screwdrivers to use for the same thing. And I hand them to me to put in my toolbox. I'm so thrilled.
That's a great metaphor.
Thank you. I use it all the time in my business. There's a lot of crossover in what we do.
For sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, it's been such a delight, and I've enjoyed talking to you. I feel like I could talk to the two of you for like 3 hours and enough, because I have so many more things to ask you about, but Let's see if Roman's there because we're getting to be the, oh, there he is. Time to end the show. I'm ready, Roman. I'm ready. I wrapped it up. I'm done. Okay.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.